Welcome to the Advocacy Podcast, Journeys to Excellence. We speak with Queen's Counsel, trial lawyers and judges from around the world about how they excel in the courtroom. Please subscribe on your favourite podcast platform and visit us for additional resources at theadvocacypodcast.com.
Welcome to a truly special episode of the Advocacy Podcast. While you're used to hearing my voice, Bibi Badejo, as your host, today we're switching things up. Stepping into the host's shoes is our esteemed previous guest, Sarah Clark KC. She sits down with the remarkable Tim Dutton, CBE KC, the visionary behind the Residential Advanced Advocacy course at Keble College, Oxford. As Keble celebrates its 30th anniversary this year, it's worth noting the profound influence Tim has had, not just on my own career trajectory, but on countless lawyers globally. This interview is a testament to his enduring impact on the world of advocacy. A heartfelt thank you to both Tim and Sarah for sharing this journey with us all.
Is the 30th anniversary of the Southeastern Circuit Advanced International Advocacy course, known around the world as the Keble course. The reason for that is that it's held every year as a week-long residential course at Keble College, Oxford. It is reliably regarded as the leading courtroom advocacy course in the world. I'm really delighted to be interviewing the creator and the founder of the Keble course, Tim Dutton, CBE KC, for him to tell us how it all began, what it is that makes Keble truly unique, and how Tim sees the role of the course, of the Keble course, in advocacy training in the future. Tim, welcome and thank you very much for agreeing to do this interview.
Well, thank you.
I suspect that there are a lot of people who really don't know anything about how Keble actually all began. It started, as we know, in 1993, and you, I think, then were 36 years old and still yourself a junior barrister because you hadn't taken silk by then. So how did someone who was 36 and still a junior come to be creating something like the Keble course?
The problem we had 30 years ago was there was no quality advanced advocacy training at the bar, but there had been for many years quality advanced advocacy training in the United States, where senior trial lawyers had appreciated that there was a lack of high quality throughout the system. There needed to be a training system put in place. They created a charity, an educational charity, called the National Institute of Trial Advocacy. And a number of us went out, I first went out in 1987, to teach on an advanced course in Florida. And that made me realize that we did not have proper advanced training at the English bar.
That gave you the idea, but what did you actually do to make it happen?
So between 87 and 93, Safo, my wife, and I went out to the States and we taught on courses. We saw what the methodology was. We then in 1990, rights of audience were opened up for solicitors to become higher rights advocates. And competition was brewing for the bar, which frankly it had never had. And as a result of that competition, solicitors began to bring in trainers, Brian Levison, Sir Brian Levison, some Americans and myself, to train city firms. And we realized that we needed to get the bar going, the bar and actually more widely, going with an advanced course. And then people from the Southeastern Circuit were sent out to America on scholarships. They came back saying how wonderful the experience had been. And finally, one winter's evening at our house in Pimlico, we sat down with David Penry Davey, then the new leader of the Southeastern Circuit, some previous course participants. And at the end of the dinner, he was persuaded that we needed a 1 week residential course. And he turned to me and said, "Will you put on a 1 week residential course next year?" And I said, "Yes, we will." And that's how we got going.
So it all started in your kitchen in 1992.
Yeah, blame it on a basement in Pimlico, yeah.
And the methodology that you mentioned that the Americans were using, how did that work?
So their method, as it had developed, was that you needed a headline, you needed a critique, which involved noting down everything the advocate had said and playing back to them what they had said. And you needed rationale and reasoning to explain why your headline, your single point for the advocate, was what they needed to work on to get better. It gave them something to focus on so that when they left the room, the teaching room, they would know what to do and could do something better next time. Now, if you repeat that over a week with three or four times a day, by the end of the week, you've had a very large meal of single points to work on, but each of which you can absorb, and it was focused, therefore, and disciplined.
You see, I remember, I mean, I was called in 94, and I remember that at that time there was no formal advocacy training at all for the bar. We had a bit at bar school and then nothing else, nothing formal or informal. And what we had at bar school was basically you would do a performance of advocacy and then the teacher would say, "Well, that was okay, but you've got to learn to ask closed questions in cross-examination. And by the way, take your hands out of your pockets and you got a bit lost there, and you know, maybe it would be better if you did it chronologically." And I just found that you just can't, when you're being given four or five things to do differently and you're that new to it all, you just can't take it in. Is that what's behind, or what was behind, the formulation of the idea that you should just give an advocate one point at a time?
Yes, it's to ensure two things. One, that the teacher is focused and disciplined and is able to provide an analysis and a point that needs to be worked on and a rationale as to why it is. So it's pupil focused. And the second thing is, by constructing the teaching in that way, your trainee absorbs what's being said. It's completely relevant to them. And then they've got something quite specific they can work on for next time. That kind of generalized stuff that you're describing is all but useless, in my view.
Yeah. Now, well, I have to say I agree.
Things had started to get going just at the time you were being called. The two Michaels, Michael Hill and Michael Sherard of Gray's Inn and Middle Temple, respectively, had invited George Hampel over from Australia to give a trainer's course. He had been to the Nita Boulder course in Colorado and had worked on the teaching method. And the Inns were roughly at the same time using what they now call the Hampel method, although its roots all lie in the American Nita teaching methodology. They had started to get going with that, but it was nascent roughly at the time you were called.
The two Michaels invited George Hampel over, and who came to watch and what actually happened when he came over?
So there was an invited group at the Inns of a relatively small number of people interested in advocacy training from the Inns, and they then took this methodology back to their Inns. They set up a committee, which later I chaired, and to try to coordinate between the Inns. And it was gradually getting going. but at a simple level, it was for pupils, and the course materials were simple. And what I knew from the work we'd been doing in America and so on was you actually need to challenge people in the period after pupillage with difficult materials where you're having to analyze complex problems and winnow down the materials, work out what it is you need. And Keeble really was designed to fill that need, the need for a practicing advocate to know what to do.
I mean, one of the things that I think there was a perception amongst the bar, and perhaps this was one of the challenges that you had in persuading people to do the first Keeble, which is that advocates are born rather than made.
Yes, it's a sort of fundamental misconception which had lived within the bar for hundreds of years. And it's the equivalent of saying this: don't worry, Amadeus Mozart was a child prodigy. He didn't need to learn anything because he's a born musician. Whereas in fact, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart learned at the feet of Leopold Mozart, a very ambitious man for his child, a gifted musician and a superb trainer, a teacher. Exactly the same is true for the bar. And of course, you may have the innate skills to be an advocate, but are you not going to be a better violinist for being taught by Yehudi Menuhin? Of course you are. So it was a fundamental misconception. And even now, you occasionally hear people saying, you're either a born advocate or you're not. Sorry, you may have the innate skills, but you've got to hone them. You've got to nurture them. And advocacy teaching demonstrates that you will.
So back then to 1992 in your kitchen, David Penrhyn-Davy, who was the leader of the Southeastern Circuit, in effect gave you the green light. But were you surprised that that it was given to you to actually organise the first course and put it on, rather than perhaps someone or a group of people more senior?
It was a bit of a surprise and an enormous compliment. But then I just had to get on with it. But it would be a great mistake to think that there wasn't a team of us from the very beginning on the first Keeble course. Geoffrey Nice, now Sir Geoffrey Nice, Joe Corner, Sappho, my wife, the presiding judges of the circuit, you know, people like Michael Wright, Bill Gage, Tony Hidden, Anne Ebsworth, and in time, a number of other people, including the great advocates and judges of the day, came onto the course. And there was always a core team, both with me and around me. So although, you know, I kicked it off and wrote the materials and used what I'd been learning to design the program of the course, a great number of other people were involved in getting it going.
One of the names I'd just like to pick up on, if I can, is your wife, Sappho, Sappho Dias, who's herself a barrister, many years standing. And I think it's fair to say, and I've seen this myself from the years when I used to help you when you were running the course, how much, frankly, of the work that went into it was down to her. And indeed, writing materials and helping to shape the course and coming to teach for many years and the support that she gave to you. Is there anything that you'd like to say about Sappho?
Absolutely, yeah. She wrote the first two or three criminal problems. She'd been teaching in America as well. And when you're creating a course and trying to get it running, it's intense enough, even if it's been running for 30 years. But boy, oh boy, it's very, very intense when you're trying to get the thing off the ground and make it grow roots. And without Sappho, it simply wouldn't have been possible. Indeed, it became a whole family enterprise because my daughter Pia came as a helper, then a singer, and it didn't put her off. She became a barrister. But the need for teamwork, particularly in the early stages, was just enormous. And so it wouldn't have been possible without Sappho.
I mean, in many ways, I think my perception was that you and Sappho were very much a team and that you ran Keeble together and were the ones who, you know, put one foot in front of the other to make it happen and keep it happening.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was it's certainly how it came across to me, because it was super intense. Just the planning, and Sappho would be contacting faculty members and using her considerable powers of persuasion whilst I was writing materials and programs and contacting people. So yeah, it was a huge team effort.
So the decision was taken anyway to make it a residential course. How did it end up at Keeble?
Confession, I had been to Keeble, and so I knew the college. First of all, we needed a good academic residential place which was large enough to expand to take quite a large number of people. And you've got a learning environment. It's a beautiful place to be. You go inside college, and the only way out during the course is to dig a tunnel, and if you're lucky, and get to the Lammen Flag. But it's a kind of nurturing bubble, and we didn't want to go to a hotel. We wanted it to be an important academic supportive institution in a recognized leading university. So Keeble fitted all of those, ticked all those boxes.
I've certainly heard a number of people refer to it as the Keeble bubble, and it does feel like that because the course is pretty intense. And of course, the beauty of the environment, I think, is all an important part. Because if you were to hold the course in London and everyone goes home every evening, that perhaps it doesn't give people opportunities to wind down together and to socialize together and to talk. And do you think that that's as important a part as what goes on in the teaching rooms?
Yes, it is. It's critically important that you've got a collegiate environment where faculty, trainers, trainees are living and working together. They see each other at mealtimes. They have conversations across meals in exactly the same way as collegiate institutions function and thrive. It's a really important part of the course.
I certainly remember when I was on the course as a participant in 1999, being struck by that and actually making some friends amongst the faculty that are still friends today.
Yeah.
In due course became mentors, etc.
Yeah. People will be pleasantly surprised by the friendships they make, not just amongst barristers, but solicitors, judges, international practitioners, and invitations come out of Keeble to go abroad and so on. So it's a thriving, collegiate, very friendly environment, albeit with this intense work ethic that persists right through the week.
Certainly, I think that's one of the things that keep a lot of people coming back to Keeble year after year. And also people who, you know, have come as participants and then come back as helpers, then they become advocacy trainers. And now we have people, I was one, but there are now a number of others who are now trainers at Keeble.
Yes.
And one of the things that they enjoy the most is, I suppose, the social side, which, let's face it, used to be a huge part of the bar, but really isn't now in the same way that it was.
Yes. I mean, you don't have to, if you're having breakfast, lunch, dinner, you will learn a lot from each other and make lasting friendships. The other thing that happens is that when you're against people who've been at Keeble, you behave yourselves. You're always on your best mettle. And if you're in front of any of the judges who've been there likewise. So it encourages high standards of behavior generally, you know, amongst those you've been lucky enough to meet. And it should become self-perpetuating. As you're an example of this, an early course participant now directing it, means I can just hang up my boots and it will continue to thrive for generations to come. That's the whole part of the point of it. We wanted that from the very beginning.
Can we then go back to the trainers? Because you spoke about how you had a huge amount of support and goodwill from a lot of significant people. And you know, that included the bar, the judiciary, overseas trainers. I think you had a lot of support from the US. But you spoke about having a core. Where did you get your core? And who would you say were the key ones?
And during the 5 or 6 years that people have been going out to America since I'd been going, different people would go and teach. So people like Jeffrey Nice had been to teach, and others. So that gave us people who'd had the American experience. We had three really experienced and gifted American trainers who had made some of their own UK contacts. Brian Leveson being one. As I mentioned, Jeffrey Nice, Joe Corner. And then there were judges who had, and other advocates who'd been part of the Hampel course, who were prepared to come to Keble. We were very keen to get important people in the law in, presiding judges, resident circuit judges, senior silks, Tony Scrivener, Gareth Williams, then Lord Williams, became Attorney General, Leader of the House of Lords, Lord Goldsmith, a whole number, Sir Sidney Kentridge. And they would demonstrate their skills, which were pretty awe-inspiring for most of us. And it also gave the course a great deal of credibility and kudos.
So the first course then, how did you put that together and where did you get the materials from?
So I put the program together from the work I'd been doing for the previous 5-6 years. The materials that we used to begin with were some of the National Institute of Trial Advocacy materials, which we anglicized with their permission and credit. We used an American commercial problem to do with delivery of computer chips, which Don Beskin, who taught on the first course, had written, which again we anglicized. And we took a criminal case, which was a relatively simple assault case from memory, into the teaching. But on the very first year, the trial was all on one problem. We didn't split civil from criminal. Then, as by the time of the second year, I'd written the steel pressings problem, and we'd begun to get the experts involved. We'd had accountants in the first year, and during the course of the second year, we got the Davitt and Lowler medical problem, which I wrote with St. Thomas's Hospital, going. So by the time of the second year, we'd got a really good quality set of materials, and we were able to split civil and crime. And then we built in the progression from case analysis, submissions, through to trial. We worked on that from year one, and we just kept trying to improve it as the years went by.
And I think you had something like 40 participants and about 14 odd trainers for the first course. Where did you get the participants from?
That was done by advertising. We produced a really ritzy poster and word of mouth. And we went to, particularly to the heads of, through the Southeastern Circuit, with the support of David Penry Davy and other circuit leading lights. We went to the big sets of chambers and said, we want people to come on the course. Will you, the chambers, pay for one or two people to come? I approached civil sets, people like Fountain Court. Peter Goldsmith was supportive. And our core group came from that combination of advertising and word of mouth. On the posters, we used to put who the faculty were and what, and we'd list the things you would achieve, and that you'd have both individual teaching and feedback and a trial, with video films to take away. So it had a kind of, it was new, and it had a name cachet, which meant people flooded in. At least 40 was our maximum for the first course.
Yeah, we now do probably double that. Yeah. And it's crept up, I think, over the 30 years. And one of the core things, and we still do this, is we're very, very dependent on the feedback that we get from the participants. Yeah. And we get quite a high return in terms of the questionnaires that we ask them to fill in at the end of the course, even though most people dread doing that. And we really do scrutinize it and act on it. And I remember very much learning how to do that from you and how important that was.
Yeah, we did that from the
How
very
was
beginning.
The feedback? How was the feedback after year one and thereafter?
So, first of all, I always wanted feedback from every participant. And we started that from the very beginning. And also from every participant on the performance of faculty members. The whole idea was you'd get peer review from the trainees of the trainers. And that was very important to improving the course, not least as to the structure of the materials and teaching, but also as to individual trainers. Because if you don't peer review yourselves, as we know from the medical profession, and we've been slow to pick up with at the bar, peer review is critically important. And so trainers who didn't pass muster weren't invited back. But in truth, people are frightened of peer review. Once you get used to it, you welcome it.
There came a point, didn't there, where compulsory training for new practitioners came in. Did that change what the fundamentals of what you thought Keeble should be doing? And if so, in what way?
Not fundamentally. In fact, in the first few years of NPP, or 45 hours, people signed up to the course because we were taking people out of pupillage in their first 3 years of tenancy. And they'd get their whole 45 hours in 1 week of Keeble to a very high standard. So that meant that we were packed to the gunnels with the participants we could take. As time went on, because there was NPP provision, as the years went by, Keeble became more, if you like, focused on people towards the end of NPP, maybe 2 years into practice, up to 8, 9, or 10, even more. But that was a gradual evolution, not a fundamental change.
Yeah. One of the things you mentioned earlier was that I think for the first course, you didn't split criminal or civil practitioners into separate groups and just taught everyone together.
Yeah.
But I think from year two onwards, you did split them into civil or criminal groups.
Yes.
What was the thinking behind doing that?
Well, keeping them both together, point one, good advocacy is universal. You'll be a good criminal advocate and a good civil advocate if basically you're a good advocate. If you know the essentials of advocacy, you may paint things in slightly brighter colors in front of a jury than in front of a judge, but the basics are essentially the same. But we split into two because the bar is and was becoming increasingly specialized. The era of the general practitioner was diminishing, and people wanted training in the subject matter. They felt that their advocacy would get better if you focused them into their specialisms in chambers. If you were to ask me, is that in fact right? I don't myself think it is. I grew up as a general practitioner and would adapt what I needed to do depending on whether I was doing crime or civil. But the fact is, you have to live with the world we have developed, which is highly specialized, and you need to adapt the course to suit that world. And that's what we were doing.
Yeah. I suppose my perception of it over the years really is people just feel more comfortable. And if they feel more comfortable because they feel they're amongst peers, then they're going to be more relaxed and they're going to be more receptive and maybe less defensive.
Yes, that's a very good point. There's a contrasting point to make. We used to do cross-examination on previous inconsistent statements. And for a civil practitioner to be alongside a criminal practitioner doing that was wonderful for teaching experience. And then you ask yourself, what are you doing when you're cross-examining in a big commercial case where all of the statements are written and you're comparing what's in the statements to the contemporaneous documents? What you're actually doing is perpetually cross-examining on inconsistent statements. But there you go. We divided, but one should be a little careful not to think that the skill sets don't cross over. And indeed, the really great advocates of all generations have been great advocates in different fields. I come back to Sidney Kentridge by way of one example, a man who's done murder, terrorism trials, huge commercial cases, focusing on skill and principle.
On a similar theme, one of the things that we always get civil practitioners complaining about at Keeble and indeed other training courses is, why do we have to do training in examination in chief? We don't do that in the Chancery Division or the QBD or wherever. I know what my answer is to that, and I'd just be interested for you to tell us all once and for all why civil practitioners need to know this stuff.
Well, let's start with a very simple reason. You cannot re-examine a witness, which you're going to have to do in the Chancery Division after he or she has had a Keeble-style cross-examination. You can only re-examine by knowing how to examine in chief, by asking open-ended questions which have got focus points within them from the cross-examination without leading to enable the witness to recover or do the best he or she can. That's the first relatively simple point. The second is rather more fundamental. In order to do these complex commercial and chancery cases, advocates are routinely interviewing their clients, taking or being involved in proof taking. You cannot take a good proof or indeed good instructions from a client without being able to examine in chief. You've got to understand how to develop a narrative using open questions in order to get a good witness statement, and one that won't fall foul of cross-examination because you, the advocate or solicitor, haven't understood how to ask an open, non-leading question. So it's actually critically important. I hope that's the answer.
Well, I hope so. And that's why we still make them do it, even 30 years on. Now, you spoke earlier about the complexity of the materials and how you felt that certainly more advanced advocates needed more challenging, meaty materials that would themselves become part of the overall teaching exercise. How did you actually come up with your own materials, having borrowed quite heavily from the Americans to start off with?
The experience I'd had meant I knew what a good case file would look like for teaching purposes. You know that if you're teaching in a group, you're going to need four different topics. So you can have four people on each side and work the topic up. So I knew from the materials I've been working with and the nature of them, the level at which I thought we needed to pitch it. And I had myself, you know, by 1995, I was, you know, 15, 16 years call. I'd been doing cases which I knew could become good teaching materials with suitable adaptation. And I'd been working with endocrinologists on medical negligence types of cases and cases involving type 1 diabetes. And I knew from those cases how we might work a case up. So I took one of my own cases. Steel pressings is a variant of a case of my own. And I adapted that for Keeble. And Davitan Lawler was a, in fact, in real life, much more complex than it is at Keble, and that's complex enough, case about a nurse who had type 1 diabetes, who went into a coma. And I was given the patient materials with permission and all of that, and I worked it up with the medical team to pitch it for your middle junior years of practice, giving you a challenge, the sort of thing you might have before a trial when you think, oh my God, I'm not going to get through this. And Keble will take you through it and make you better for it. Giving you two simple materials. Simple materials are fine in pupillage, but real life is much more complicated than, you know, knocking someone over on a pavement. You've got to get into the stuff of real life, and that's what the materials are designed to do.
And of course, we're still using steel pressings and Davitan Lawler today, although they've been updated over the years. I think one of the things that I consistently see with participants is that they start off, they have a case analysis for the criminal and civil case that they're going to do for the week. They then get that, they get used to that case. They start to you know, develop their skills on that case. And then come Thursday night, suddenly they're faced with Davitan Lawler or the accountancy equivalent, at which point they are usually exhausted, and all of them are juggling, no doubt, busy practices as well. And I stand and look at the looks on their faces when we do the talk on experts on the Thursday night, and then have the expert conferences. And I can see them all thinking, I just don't know how I'm going to get through this. Yep. But then come Friday and they have got through it. And then you see completely different people on the Friday night celebrating with their friends, old and new. And it seems to me that all of them have learned something about resilience. And that's certainly how I felt when I was a participant, that I'd learned something about what I could do when I was really up against
it. Welcome to real life. Problems occur in the life of a busy advocate when something goes wrong and they are too busy and they haven't developed the resilience necessary when they've got a trial brewing to focus on a difficult consultation with an expert for the next trial and to prepare for it. And Keble is designed with the expert problem placed two-thirds of the way through the week to put you through that experience and understand how to deal with it and still perform to a high standard. And that's why you get this exuberance on the Friday night, because you've got through it, but wait for it, you've then got the trial on the Saturday. Welcome to real life, be it slightly modified real life.
Yeah, no, I remember that very well. Just focusing a bit more on the expert sessions, because one of the things that certainly at the time made Keble unique, and in many ways still does, is the huge support that we have from the doctors and the accountants. Now, you spoke a little bit about the doctors, and I think you said that you'd done some medico-legal work. But I think it's also the case, isn't it, that you are a type 1 diabetic yourself.
Yes.
And that the people that helped you to write Davitan Lawler were, in fact, doctors that you had known personally as well as professionally.
Yes.
And who then went on to support the course for decades thereafter.
Yeah. So my first consultant in St. Thomas's Hospital was Professor Peter Sonkson. And he was married to the senior nurse at the unit. And another person there of great distinction was Professor Clara Lowy, who became my second doctor at St. Thomas's. There's a third, in fact, third and fourth, Jake Parry and one or two others, whom I would see from time to time. And I became friends with Peter and Clara. And then these cases, the government tried to remove licenses from type 1 lorry driving diabetics. And Peter would be my expert, or Clara would be the expert on a case when we tried to get these licenses back. Or doctors from Nottingham or other regional diabetes centres. And I'd have to cross-examine other endocrinologists on the other side or government-appointed doctors. So I got to know quite a number of them. And with the St. Thomas's team, we wrote the problem. And then Peter, who had immense advocacy powers, as well as being one of the great endocrinologists of all time, like Clara, they twisted arms from other specialist centers. And there was the only time not to be a type 1 diabetic in the UK was when the Keble course was occurring, because all the leading specialists were at Keble enjoying themselves and being cross-examined and trying to get the better of the advocates. Enormous number of people came with when mobile phones were up and running, calling back to their hospitals. But we had a superb group. And likewise with the accountants, Frank Eilert and others. And it meant that we could develop good materials and you were dealing with the genuine thing. You know, you couldn't pull a fast one.
How did the relationship with Deloitte develop? Because they've been a huge, staunch supporter of the course for not quite as long as the accountants, the doctors, but certainly almost as long.
It started with Arthur Anderson, whom I'd got to know, and they came on the first course, I think a few courses after that. Then Enron came, and Arthur Anderson imploded. And the people from Arthur Anderson went elsewhere, including to Deloitte, and we worked up new problems with them. So, and by word of mouth, other accountants would be quite keen to become involved. It gives them their own courtroom experience in a safe setting.
So I think it was Frank Eilert, wasn't it, who you originally worked with, and then Simon DeQuitt took over and has been a great friend of the course thereafter.
Yes, even before that, Mark Besant as well. So there's the great thing about having a number of them is if some aren't available, you can get others. So,
And in fact, we do. I mean, now we had this year we had 15 doctors and 12 accountants.
Yeah.
So that's the level of support that we're still getting. And what I hear from the experts year on year is how they feel they get as much out of it as the advocates, yeah, and how much they enjoy as well watching the advocates improve. You know, someone who perhaps in the morning in the conference session doesn't seem to know the difference between a hypo and a hyper. Yeah. In the afternoon is nailing a cross-examination of an expert.
Yes.
And they love being part of that.
Yeah, and they do. And they love the collegiality. And as do the trainers. Quite a lot of people who are training in the expert sessions are learning as fast as those who are being trained. They all will have dealt with experts, but you always gain something when you're working at that level. As a trainer, you always are honing your own skills at the same time as imparting knowledge and teaching. So everybody gets something out of it.
I remember you saying to me very early on, if you become an advocacy trainer, you will learn as much as the people that you're training, if not more.
Yep.
And so don't ever begrudge the time that you give to it, and keep doing it. And that's absolutely been true. But the other thing is that you've always made it fun. And that was the thing about Keble. It was always fun. However exhausting and relentless it was fun.
Yes.
I don't know how you did that or whether it was the Keble magic that did that for you.
No. Well, you learn best if you're enjoying. You learn most when you laugh or when you're on the point of laughter. When you're smiling, you remember things. That was very important to ensure that it was a supportive, friendly, quite often amusing environment. Sometimes if you make a complete Horlicks of a cross-examination, you fall around laughing and you learn, and you learn something from it. And you'll remember the moment of laughter and the reason why, and it sticks with you. So it is very important that the learning environment is happy.
I mean, I do believe that we're still doing that. And I think everybody regards that as fundamental to the success of what we're doing. One of the other things I think that you fostered was an ability amongst the faculty to be a little bit humble, I suppose, and human. Mm. So, for example, no trainer in a week is going to do 100% perfect demonstrations. Everybody's going to do the odd duff one or ask a few duff questions and then go, oh dear, that didn't work very well. And actually, from the perspective of being a participant and seeing that, that was as important to me as watching the most brilliant demonstration of a closing speech I've ever seen.
Was also
to see big, powerful, successful people getting it wrong and living to fight another day.
Yeah, that was very important. When we did demonstrations, I suspect you're still doing this, Sarah, of a really good quality advocate, might do a fantastic demonstration in front of the whole group. And we would always have someone analyzing the demonstration and picking up points, if there were some, for correction, or a point for correction, and underscoring the good. But none of us are infallible. You're never infallible. We always make mistakes. And, providing trainers are generally teaching to a very high standard, you can learn from their mistakes as well as your own. So it's fine.
Yeah. And as I say, what you seemed to me to foster in everyone was just an ability to laugh at themselves.
Yeah.
And just shrug it off. And that is hugely important in practice to be able to do that, isn't it? When you walk out of court having had a bad day,
you can't let
that infect everything else.
No, and you, as life goes on, the wins get bigger, but the losses get bigger. And if you can't survive a big loss and learn how to accept it and live with it, frankly, life in the profession is going to be very, very difficult. And part of the keyboard process is you may fall completely flat on your face. You may think, I'm falling flat on my face every day, but you'll be picked up and you'll get through to the end of the week. Here's an interesting point. I don't think, certainly in my 10 years of directing it, we may have had one or two people had to leave, say, through illness, but I can remember barely anybody not coming through to the end of the week better and stronger for it. In fact, I'd like to think everybody did, regardless. So. And that is being able to fall flat on your face, pick yourself up. That's essential.
Yeah. I mean, it's still pretty much that's the case. I can't think of anybody who hasn't had that experience. And sometimes we get people, and I remember that we used to get them when you were running the course, who literally would turn up at Keeble almost as a last chance saloon, in the sense that they had just been broken by horrendous experiences in court, perhaps in their personal lives, perhaps a combination. Doesn't matter what the reasons are, but they would turn up absolutely broken, having lost all their self-confidence, their professional, just ability to function. And to have to take somebody who is that broken and put them back together in the course of a week, and then give them enough to keep them going and set them off, is an extraordinary thing to do.
Yeah.
And yet I've seen Keeble do it again and again.
Yeah.
And I've seen some of those people in practice, and I can think of some of them now, who are now successful. I know at least one who's now in Silk. And I don't know, what do you think it is about Keeble that can put people back together?
You lose self-confidence when you've had blows. And you can't express it to somebody, and you think you're beyond learning or recovering from it. The essential part of the Keeble teaching philosophy is that you will never have got to the end of pupillage without being very able. It's a highly competitive profession, and that is all reinforced at Keeble. And secondly, you realize that the teaching faculty will put the losses and blows you've suffered into their proper perspective, and they will pick up and nurture your strengths and point out that your own self-criticism, which has led to this loss of confidence, is misplaced, or if it isn't, if there's a place for it, it's a very small place, and therefore you recover
So can I just ask you then now about a topic we've touched on, which is the jury trials, and indeed the mock trials, because, of course, the civil practitioners will have a mock trial in front of a judge. But the criminal practitioners actually have quasi-real jurors who come in, members of the public, local people in Oxford will come in for lots of different reasons and will play at being a juror for a day. How did you come up with that idea and how did you get it off the ground?
So I'd seen jury trials in America, and so I knew they could work. But obviously we wanted an English jury trial. And we to get it, I taught actually at Herbert Smith. And one of the people I taught from Herbert Smith became an academic at Oxford Brookes. So I worked with her and her team on modeling the jury trial, the questions they'd be asked, how we would deal with it, how we would instruct them and keep it real. And we tried to model it exactly, as near as you can, on what would happen in the real world. So they have a separate jury instruction altogether about how they're to behave, how they try it on the evidence. They are going to be filmed and so on. And with the Oxford Brookes team, we created the jury questionnaire and we put a camera in the jury room so that the participants could see the feedback. And then after they delivered their verdicts, we got the jurors to give feedback on the advocates. They knew they were going to do it, but they were still acting as real jurors. And to get them all, we had a lady called Jane Reed, who was resident in Oxford, became the course assistant, introduced through Keeble. And she advertised on Radio Oxford and the daily newsletters. And we got a cross-section of people from Oxford, you know, people who cleaned in colleges, Oxford dons, people from car factories, your typical jury. And they all had to get on. It was all watching the films was very interesting.
Yeah, we're still using Jane, actually, and she still does it in more or less the same way. I think she uses the internet now a bit more than perhaps she could in 1994.
Great.
But yeah, we're still using her. And we still do get a real cross-section of jurors who are actually pretty representative of the sort of cross-section that you might get in real life.
Yep.
And the feedback is just invaluable. It really is.
Yep.
And it's one of the things that consistently the feedback we get is that that's one of the things that the participants appreciate the most.
Yeah.
Because, of course, with the Juries Act, you can never have that kind of feedback in anything approaching a real case, can you?
No,
it's the only opportunity you'll ever have.
Yeah, and it could. I always wanted to use this as a research model because we found that the jury verdicts were consistent. In other words, if the same evidence had been led and similarly cross-examined to in different trials, you got a consistent verdict. And during part of Keeble, the government, the Labour government, tried to do away with jury trials in certain arenas. And we were ready to say, in fact, the bar advanced an argument and won, that you shouldn't do it. And one of the arguments being used against jury trials was they're unreliable in difficult fraud cases. And we could say, look, jury verdicts are consistent with the evidence. And the idea that a judge is going to do better actually doesn't wash. So I've always felt that Keeble underpinned that central feature of our system.
And over the years, Keeble has continued to play an important role like that. For example, and this is just one of many, but one I think particularly important example, was the introduction of training advocates in how to appropriately deal with vulnerable witnesses.
Yeah.
And that came at a time where it was becoming a very important topic for obvious good reasons. But there was literally nowhere that an advocate could then go in order to get any training on how to do things properly.
Yeah, that came about because in 1999, there was the legislation that came in, which created the categories of vulnerable witnesses, where hitherto it had been relatively ad hoc. And we decided, the Keeble team, with the Criminal Bar Association, and I think the Southeastern Circuit, to put on a demonstration of a cross-examination of a vulnerable witness at the London School of Economics. In their big lecture hall, we used Pia, my daughter, who'd been there by then was 13, knew Keeble and knew barristers. She was the vulnerable witness in a side room separately filmed. She had a responsible adult with her. She was cross-examined by Michael Lawson. Then he's, you know, then became leader of the circuit and so on. And there was feedback given on the spot of the examination in chief and cross-examination in front of the judge. And then we took that to Keeble because we needed to advance the training, get people used to it, know how to deal with genuinely vulnerable people or people who at least fitted the bill for being vulnerable. How do you teach without crossing lines? And then once that had got established, the bar, the Criminal Bar Association, and the other, the INS, picked up on it, and Keeble had done its bit.
That's right. And I think at that point, we handed, obviously, that baton over, rightly, to the INS and the circuits and the specialist bar associations, and then reverted to doing what Keeble is best known for, which was the core skills and the expert training, which is what we're doing now. But do you think Keeble continues to have a relevant role to play in terms of the sort of political and societal need?
Yes, the answer is there are always going to be challenges for any profession, for the advocacy profession. It can be law changes, such as opening up rights of advocacy more broadly. It can be vulnerable witness changes, could be expert witnesses, civil procedure rules, whatever it is. If there are challenges thrown up for advocates or evidence emerging where work needs to be done, dare I say it, in examination in chief and re-examination, then Keeble is the place which should be pioneering the work, because it's such a good place over a week. If you've got 8 or 10 breakout groups, the evidence that emerges for the teaching that you're using is very strong. And it tends to mean that we can create, you know, really good quality teaching models. And there are going to be plenty in the future that we're going to have to grapple with, you're going to have to grapple with.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. Now, a couple of things, and perhaps sort of focusing back a bit more on the support that you've had. I mean, we've spoken about the faculty, we've spoken about the international support, we've spoken about the doctors, the accountants, but perhaps one organisation that deserves a little bit more treatment is the support that the course has unendingly had from the Southeastern Circuit.
Yes.
Which was visionary at the time in 1992 when Sir David Penn, who Davy, took the decision that the circuit was going to back you to do the first Keeble course.
Yeah.
But for the 30 years thereafter has been significant in terms of financial, general support, administrative support, and that still goes on to this day.
Yes.
How important do you think all of that has been to Keeble and to advocacy training generally?
Keeble simply would not have been possible without the circuit support, both in terms of resourcing, administrative help, and financially. There were some years where the subsidy from the circuit ran into many tens of thousands of pounds. And fortunately, I gather, as the course has expanded, the need for that subsidy has thankfully reduced. But the financial contribution over the years has been huge, as has been the support of local bar messes, resident judges, local leaders within each of the circuit areas, including London, which falls within the Southeastern Circuit, and Oxford. So it's been, Southeastern Circuit has been critically important to the success of Keeble. Without circuit support, frankly, it wouldn't have taken place. I'd have to find another benefactor and support. And I doubt there would have been any other organization that could have done what the circuit did.
No. And I mean, frankly, today, Aaron Dolan, who is the person who really runs Keeble, I mean, I know he lets me pretend that I do, but he does really. We literally could not run the course without him. And of course, he is the Southeastern Circuit's administrator, and they kindly allow him to run the Keeble course, you know, on their time. I mean, that's just a small example of how hugely important they still are. But one of the other ways, I mean, I know I remember the size of the subsidy, and we're not going to talk numbers, but one of the other things that they used to do was to give scholarships to overseas participants, didn't they?
Yes.
From developing jurisdictions, which proved to be hugely important in terms of the bar's international reach, as it were, and the rule of law perspective.
Yes. So we gave scholarships after the general election, first democratic election in South Africa, to some South Africans. Others would come. We did a liaison with the Florida bar and India, Pakistan. And there's a huge advantage. Firstly, it's enriching to work with people from other basically common law jurisdictions in the Commonwealth and elsewhere. It also means that not just personal relationships develop with people abroad. Some of the people go back and they become justice ministers or attorneys general and so on. And they invite people from Keeble to come and teach, or they inculcate some of the Keeble ethos into their own jurisdictions. And it's a very enriching process. And as a result of all that, I went out to Australia, Singapore, India, Pakistan, South Africa, working with the Keeble materials and working with some really interesting people in these other jurisdictions, which I might have done a little bit in practice, but not to the same extent.
No. And I think, to be honest, that still continues. You know, we have friends all over the world that we've made at Keeble, and professionally and personally. The other institutions that I think probably deserve a plug and thanks is the Inns of Court. It's fair to say that they have been, not only, of course, the Inns run their own hugely successful and important training themselves, but have provided undying support to Keeble.
Yes.
Not least of which, because they give us the trainers, the participants, of course, as well. But also, each of the Inns gives 5 scholarships per year to any participant who practices in publicly funded work and who wants to attend Keeble, which basically pays the entirety of their course fees, which is not an insignificant contribution. And it's one that the Inns have been making collectively for at least 10 years, if not more.
And
of course, as the tide has turned and things have become financially more difficult at the publicly funded bar, what it's meant is that Keeble has been able to continue to fund itself, but also to remain truly inclusive.
Yes, it was actually very important to me that we should have inclusion with the Inns. And actually, by the time of the second or third course, we'd got the teamwork going, and the scholarships which the Inns are giving for publicly funded practitioners, I mean, without that, they would not be able to come. And if you don't, the publicly funded bar is very, very important in its criminal work, family work, insofar as public funding extends there. And it's the most diverse area of the bar. So the Inn support is positively encouraging both inclusion and diversity, and ensuring that people who wouldn't get this course can get it and can keep going in the most important area of practice. So it's the Inns do need to be thanked, I agree.
And I think one of the early bodies, I think one of the things you said was that the Inns in the early stages banded together and formed an organization to deal with advocacy training, which initially was called the Advocacy Training Council, and then more recently renamed the Inns of Court College of Advocacy.
Yes.
Which in itself, of course, now runs its own bar course, of course, and is groundbreaking and world leading in its own right in terms of its contribution, but has also always been, and I've got personal experience of this, a huge friend to the Keble course.
Yes. It's partly in 2002 to 2004, I chaired a Bar Council working party, and we were looking at advocacy assessment and training and the delivery of it. And it went on for 2 years. And those recommendations recommended that there should be an advocacy training council from which the college emerged. So that work was all going on with a number of us from Keble. I was chairing it, but the people like Lord Walker used to come and teach at Keble, would then teach at Lincoln's, and that the DPP. So we got buy-in from all of the institutions that are using advocacy or teaching it, and there was by 5 or 6 years into Keble, frankly, excellent harmony right across the board, including with the CPS. City law firms who would send people and so on. So it's slight danger that we sing our own successes a little bit too much. There have been plenty of bumps along the way, and there will be more in future.
We've spoken about the Keble bubble, but the other thing that people speak about, and I've certainly used this expression, but I've definitely heard it many times over the last 20 odd years that I've been involved in the course, is the Keble magic. And I'm not sure that I can easily articulate what that is. I'd be interested to know if you can.
Well, for me, teaching on it and working on it over the years, the real magic, the most rewarding thing, is to work with somebody. If you're a trainer, as a trainee with a trainee, and seeing what you're saying actually giving rise to real improvement, it's the most rewarding experience. And that experience can be repeated not only during the course of a week, but sometimes several times a day. And it's quite a drug. That experience for me is as important as winning a really difficult case, because you know that you're having a lasting effect in the same way as teachers did at school or at university, whom you remember. But seeing the effect visibly in front of your eyes is terribly rewarding. And I think if you feed on that, that may become your magic, dare I say it, magic mushroom. But it's that for me is what lies at the heart of it. It's the witnessing of improvement, which is really thrilling.
The other thing that other professions have said to me is that there isn't really any other profession where people would literally give up a week of their time pro bono to go along and threaten, at risk making a fool of themselves, teaching advocacy to the next generation, or teaching anything to the next generation if they weren't being paid for it. And they find it extraordinary that we are actually prepared to do that. And of course, we do that. And it's not just Keble, the inns and the circuits. You know, we all do that for each other. It's a huge part of the profession. But what we also have, of course, and you've touched on this, is advocates who then become judges. And we now have judges who are in the Court of Appeal, senior Court of Appeal judges, who every year will give up a week of time, not just pro bono, but they actually take it as holiday to come and teach. Yeah. And I'm not trying to just single out the Court of Appeal judges. We have High Court judges, we have circuit judges, district judges, as well as business practitioners. And every year they will block out a week in their diary to come and teach at Keble.
Yes, if anybody wanted to say there's no public spiritedness in the legal profession, come and see what people are doing on advocacy training. That gives you the answer. There is something else, which is judges are the consumers of advocacy, and they need us to do well, because otherwise the courts don't function properly. The Court of Appeal has got, I think, about 40% of permission applications now are by litigants in person because of the loss of legal aid. There are no advocates there, and the judges are having to spend a good chunk of their time with litigants in person, which in turn means that they need the bar, and including the pro bono elements of it, to be performing to a very high standard, because they're totally reliant on the standards of professionalism from the bar and from advocates. So there's a mutual interest. It's not the fundamental reason why people give up time. It's public spiritedness.
And certainly I feel I can say that my advocacy is a lot better than it would ever have been had I not been to Keble in 1999 and then kept coming back all of those years. And I can now see other people who, like me, got that Keble magic and wanted to hold on to it. And those are the people I'm certain that are going to be running Keble in 10, 20 years' time.
Hope so.
I'm sure of it. Yep. Volunteer. That leads me on to, I've only got a couple more questions, but Keble 30 years on seems to me, and I suppose I may be biased, to be just as relevant as it was. Perhaps not quite as urgent a need as it was 30 years ago, but an important need in developing advanced advocates. And I don't see that changing. And at the 50th anniversary, I hope there'll be two people sitting where you and I are now having a similar conversation. But what do you see as being the way that Keble should remain relevant for the next 20 years?
The fundamentals are going to stay the same. In order to persuade a judge, a tribunal, a jury of the power of your case, you're going to have to be a good advocate, whether it's orally or in writing. And one of the things we haven't touched on is that Keble does address written advocacy as well, skeleton arguments and how you construct them, and they're critiqued as well. And there's going to be increasing pressure as time goes on more efficient use of written submissions. The commercial court now limits you to 25 pages, That means your advocacy has to be focused and disciplined and well-constructed. You've got to discard irrelevancies. You've got to focus on the important points. And in that environment, Keble is extremely important because it's going to have to confront the challenges which the world, the legal world is facing, the world at large that needs lawyers is facing. There are some other challenges, actually, which I've spoken of elsewhere. We're living in a more electronic world. We're using iPhones and media, electronic media, with the result that actually we are losing our ability to use good vocabulary in open dialogue with well-constructed sentences and not too many sub-clauses, as I'm just illustrating. Now, there is going to be an increasing premium as time goes by on very good oral and written advocacy, the use of really good expressive English. And Keble is one place where I think you will be focusing more and more on that, as I'm afraid vocabulary and use of language, construction and proper grammar all diminish because of our dependency on flicking on our iPhones and social media. That is having a deleterious effect on advocacy.
I just wanted to end on, I suppose, move away slightly from Keble the entity to talk a little bit about you, if I may. You very frankly told us that, you know, you've had your health battles over the years. You've been a type 1 diabetic since you were 17. You've had to manage that all the way through your illustrious career at the bar and through all of the advocacy training that you've done. And then on top of that, a few years ago, you were diagnosed with motor neurone disease. Despite all of that, you continue to have an illustrious career, a very fulfilling life, and are involved in more things than I suspect many of us are. But do you think that Keble in any way has been a part of how you've managed your various health issues over the years?
Or the other way around?
Or the other way around?
Yeah, the type 1 diabetes. I was very, very ill when I was diagnosed with it. 3 weeks in hospital and pretty much 2 months off just before my A-levels. I nearly died. So it made me realize that life could be very short. And I'd achieved by that point, a few weeks before A-levels, nothing to show for it, you know, a bit of music and all that sort of stuff. And it made me very, very determined to live every day fully. So the illness, the type 1 diabetes, actually had that advantage. It focused my attention on the brevity of life, the need to fill every day as much as possible and achieve as much as you can. I don't mean an overweening ambition for huge sums of money, but things that are worthwhile. You're not remembered because you made a lot of money. You're remembered because you've achieved something which is of benefit to your own generation and future generations. So it did come out of that mindset, which the type 1 diabetes had a big contribution for. The other thing was, it's very, very hard work keeping your practice going, keeping keyboard going, all of that. And the disease, you've got to be very disciplined if you've got type 1 diabetes. You've got to do your injections, you've got to eat properly. You can't go out boozing night after night. And the result of that was, I think I did manage to remain, despite the nights at the Lamb and Flag, which I periodically participated in, pretty disciplined during the preparation for and during the course. And I would put a lot of that down to the type 1 diabetes. Motor neuron disease is a slightly different topic. There you've got to, with that, I've got to adapt and give up things which I aren't realistic. I don't do jury, so I don't do trials anymore. Did my last trial a year ago. But it's added to the lesson I learned with the type 1 diabetes, which is you've got to focus your attention on what you can do, achieve as much as you can with such abilities as remain. Fortunately, the brain is still going and the voice is still going. And I can still operate a computer using voice technology. And do the most you can with those things. And the absolute epitome of that is Stephen Hawking, who lived for 50 years with MND and was one of the leading cosmologists. Well, you know, thank you very much. There's Keeble, my answer to cosmology.
Another topic that I know is been an important part of your life is music. Yeah. And I think you were, if I remember correctly, a chorister in your teens. Is that right?
Yeah, I was chorister at Durham Cathedral, yeah.
That's right. And you've always enjoyed singing and classical music. And one of the things that you did shortly after, I think, you were diagnosed with MND was to start something called the Temple Choral Society. That's right.
Yeah.
That used to sing in Temple Church, amongst other places.
Still does.
Still does, sorry, yeah, yes, yeah, you're right, yeah. It does, with a couple of years off for COVID. But you introduced music to Keeble, and indeed music's still a part of Keeble's life. And the music that we've heard at the start of this and that we will hear at the end is music that's also been part of the Keeble's life, because one is your daughter Pia singing and another Rupert Pardo, who's himself a barrister. And so how has that love of music fed into your professional life, your practice?
To be a very good musician, not that I was very good, but I was, yeah, okay. You've got to have two essential qualities. One, the discipline of learning the music. It's an awful lot of learning, quite a bit of mathematical stuff, which I'm not very good at when you're looking at notes and combinations and so on. And the other is expression, how to express yourself. Those qualities are essential qualities for advocacy. A really good piece of music, well performed, is inspirational. During the hearing of it, you reflect on what you're hearing, and it gives you a kind of quiet, resolute inner purpose, which of itself can mean that your advocacy will improve because it's lifted you to a higher plane. So on the Friday night, we put music on with that intention. It's enjoyable, but it would lift people up, make them think that they just had a wonderful experience. When you're in that frame of mind, as when you're laughing, you tend to perform better. And so that's what lies behind it. Rupert and I sang Au Fond du Temple Saint, the aria from the Pearl Fishers, at Keble 2014, 3 weeks after my MND diagnosis. So that's of special import to me. And Pia, who's singing the flower duet with her singing coach, Sarah Gabriel, also sang at Keble. And as I said, she and Sappho were a very important part of it. And they sang that duet, or Pia sang that duet at Keble, and she's sung it since in Temple Church. So that's why we begin with the flower duet and we end with the Au Fond du Temple Saint. They're both important pieces.
So I've got one last question. And in order to sort of wind up to the question, my headline will be Ask Shorter Questions, but I'm going to embarrass you slightly because I think it's important that we put on record that not only did you start Keble at the age of 36 when you were still a junior, but you then went on to take Silk in 1998. You were chair of the Southeastern Circuit from 2004 to 2006. You were chair of the bar in 2008. And in 2016, you were made a Commander of the Order of the British Empire, which is the highest ranking order of the British Empire that you were given for services to the UK legal system. Most people would never achieve any one of those things. You've done all of that, as well as battling, as you've told us, that the health issues that you have. And yet, the speech that you made at the 20th anniversary of the course, which I think was either just before or just after your diagnosis
just
with MND.
Just before, 2013.
Just before, that's right. You said, amongst other things, that the proudest achievement of your career was to, what you described, have fathered this important child, the Keble course. So my question is, because there is a question, do you still feel that way? And if so, why?
Yes, I do. Because it's, you go back to the question you asked earlier about the magic. There is something quite thrilling about A, creating the course, but more significant, enabling people to improve before your eyes and seeing the improvement happen. And knowing that providing everybody nurtures the course as you are doing, that will continue. That's long lasting. One has professional successes and somebody goes away richer or poorer. Somebody does or doesn't go to prison. And those are obviously very important and they can be thrilling or not, as the case may be. But the course is, I'm very proud of it. And it actually, because it expanded outwards, it also was a significant reason why I took Silk and secondly got the CBE. So thank you very much, Keble. I've got something in it for me.
Well, Tim, for whatever you've got out of Keble, it's nothing compared to what you have put into the course and the profession. And we wouldn't be here 30 years on had it not been for you. So thank you very much for your time and for agreeing to do this interview. Tim Dutton, CBE KC.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you.
Are you an experienced trial lawyer who feels like you've hit a plateau? If you want to take your advocacy skills to the next level, feedback is key, and I have just the thing for you. I'm Bibi, the voice of the Advocacy Podcast and founder of The Advocacy Coach. Every month, I host The Advocacy Clinic. It's a free and unique online platform for lawyers to practice oral arguments or witness handling with seasoned actors. Then they receive real-time, personalized feedback. Whether you actively engage or simply observe, it's an unmatched opportunity to learn and hone your advocacy skills. To join, just sign up at theadvocacycoach.com/clinic. Become unstoppable at court with The Advocacy Coach, your partner in your journey to advocacy excellence.
Thank you for listening to The Advocacy Podcast, Journeys to Excellence. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe and visit us at theadvocacypodcast.com for reading lists and other resources. Until next time.